How come they call it Easter Sunday? Why not Taking Back Sunday?
Well, Taking Back Easter Sunday was their that was their holiday album.
Okay. See, here I was worried you were going to break me down so badly. But, you went with the riff. So.
Well, on Taking Back Easter That's Sunday, exciting. They make dang sure to do that.
I was never a fan of Taking Back Sunday.
Yeah, no?
No.
Just honestly, I looked up the band name for the joke about Easter Long Weekend, and then the one song that I knew was the one song everybody knows about them, and I was like, great, I can make this a riff for the podcast. Mm.
Well,
which always starts out in the worst way.
I can promise you, so. I actually know many more songs than that one by them. And that isn't even the first song by them I think of when I think of them. So that was a good joke. It worked out well.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. All right. Theme song. Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Nothing to Fear, a weekly horror movie podcast. Every week on the show, myself, Billy Schultz, and my two friends, we break down a different horror movie. All through April, we've gone through vampire movies, and we're finishing it off this week. Nope, again, that's not what's happening.
Jesus Christ.
Okay, listeners, I've had a hell of a week. In this week, I got COVID and I lost my power in my apartment and had to get an extension on a school project. So let's just say the second week of April for me has been quite intense, but I will share a little bit more of that detail in a second after I say hello to my co-hosts and co-friends and wonderful people, Luke Mason, Alex Wan. Luke, how you doing today?
Pretty good. Yeah. It's a nice long weekend. Enjoying all of that. So, yeah, everything's going well. Thanks for asking.
Good. You're welcome. Good Easter so far? You got plans later?
Just trivia.
Just trivia. Always
trivia.
The one constant in the universe.
That's right.
All right.
E equals MT squared.
That's right. Easter equals massive trivia squared.
Yeah, that's right.
that's how it goes.
That's right.
Also, I'm joined with Alex Wan. How you doing, Alex? In a different recording space today.
Yeah, I'm in the other room. They are fixing holes in the other room, or my room. So the guy comes in on Tuesday, and I'm like, oh, do you think you can get this done? Like, how quick do you think you can get this done? And he goes, oh, I should probably be able to get it done by Friday. I'm like, oh, you work Friday? And he goes, oh, that's right. It's a long weekend. Probably not. I'll probably have to come back next week. And then I go, oh, are you sure you can't finish it this week? He's like, nah, this job is going to take like 3 days. And I go, well, today's Tuesday. And then you get Wednesday and Thursday. That's 3 days. And he's like, you know what? You're right. Yeah, I could probably get this done by Thursday. Great. Perfect. Come back Thursday night. Not done. So now I'm in here.
I'm sorry, buddy. And I'm betting May is Monday a holiday for you as well, so he'll
won't be back no. Tuesday. Well, I think he works Monday.
Okay.
Not a lot of people get Monday off, actually.
Right.
So maybe
I'll
be back.
The room saga continues.
By Monday night.
Yeah. Hopefully you get your room patched up.
Yeah, this mattress sucks ass.
Yeah.
I don't know how I slept on it for 20 years of my life, but...
I think maybe that's the reason, is if you have a 20-year-old mattress, they don't last forever.
Yeah, well, mattresses are expensive, so.
Mattresses are so expensive. So expensive. Yes. Well, good. Thank you for being here. It's nice to see you with you. Nice to see you. Do you have any Easter plans, or do you do anything for Easter? Or?
No, I don't.
No. Just hanging out. All right. Jeez, apologies for all the coughs and muting. I'm really going to have my editing work cut out for me, but yeah, as I teased earlier on, this week has been very stressful. On Tuesday, I started feeling under the weather. I started feeling really sick and coughing a lot, and just I didn't crack a fever, but I was not feeling good. Just to be cautious, I took a COVID test. It didn't show that I had contracted the COVID virus, but on Wednesday when I took another test, I still, as I was not feeling any better, I tested positive. And
this is your third time?
This is round two for me. Round two. So two kicks at the COVID can. And it all happened to coincide with a intensely long and brutal ice storm that happened on Wednesday all through the day here in Montreal. It was like freezing rain, and I was just completely out of it inside, so I didn't have to go out, thankfully. But I went to bed around 7 o'clock, and the power was still on. And then when I woke up, all the power was out in my apartment, in the whole complex. In fact, there was over 1 million people in Quebec without power because of the storm. And so people were stranded. And there's actually still about, I think, 2,000 or 3,000 people on the island that still don't have power now, almost 5 days later. So Quebec Hydro is out there trying to restore it. But all through Thursday, without any power in the apartment and being sick, Kelly went to her uncle's place, who did happen to have power, to like just sort of chill out and be away from me while I was sick. And it gave me a chance to like do nothing. I had no internet, I had no phone, no TV or anything. So I slept and ate food that didn't need to be heated up and read, which was kind of great, but I wish I didn't have to get COVID for it. So, you know, we make do and we get going. This time it has not hit me as hard. Like it was only really 2 days where it was really bad. And today I feel great. I still have a cough and my throat's a little bit sore, but we won't be going to the family Easter dinner this evening because Kelly has also contracted a cold. She still hasn't tested positive when we do the COVID test, but she has all the same symptoms as me. So if it looks like a duck and sounds like a duck and coughs like a duck, then it's probably a duck. And so, yeah, I'm just this like Sunday afternoon / morning ritual of recording feels very like back to normal. Routine is getting back on track. And so I'm grateful to get to talk with you folks about scary movies and all that that entails.
Back to the present.
Mm. Well, that sucks. Sorry about that.
Yeah. Thanks.
Ice storm. So what entails like an ice storm? Is it different than a blizzard or?
Yeah, so it was freezing rain basically. And we went out. I might post some pictures onto the Instagram after this, but it was like a really, really heavy rainstorm, but it was right underneath the freezing level. So everything just got encased in this like ice. And of course, tree branches broke and power lines got ripped down and like, you know, cars got damaged and stuff. And so it was like, yeah, rain, wind, ice. And the last time it happened here, the kind of the big one of the last 25 years happened in 1998, which was it happened in January. And it was like people were without power across like southern Ontario and Quebec for some places up to like 3 weeks. And it was really bitterly cold, like minus 20. So we got lucky, I guess, in a sense that the day after, the Thursday afternoon, it had gone from freezing to 14, 15 above. And so all the ice was gone. Like we went for a walk Thursday afternoon. And if you didn't see all the tree branches and broken trees and stuff, you would think it's just a regular spring day. So The ice part of the ice storm disappeared within a day, but the effects linger on.
Mm. Yeah, it's been very nice here. Like 14, it's going to be 16 today. Pretty sick. I'm going to go sit on a balcony later.
Oh yeah, balconies are up and running.
Yeah.
As soon as it gets double digits in Calgary, they're like, put the umbrellas up. It's beer time.
Aren't those patios?
Some patios are balconies.
It's balcony season.
It's balcony season, guys.
Like I'm talking about my patio balcony. It's elevated. It's a balcony, right?
Yeah, that's what I mean. But I mean, like,
it's off the ground.
Bars don't really have balconies.
No, I'm not going to a bar later. I went to one last night. I'm gonna go sit on my.
I know, but
balcony.
I think Billy was referencing a bar.
I was referencing a bar. I was referencing the.
Can you
the
give Billy a break?
Culture.
Okay.
No.
COVID ice storm. No. We don't have to be pedantic here.
I am the pedantist. On this.
It's pronounced pedantist.
Yes, that's right. Oh man, my job is getting you slurped.
Yes. Sorry, my exemplar of what a patio is, the old oak tree tavern,
right.
Rooftop patio. Mm-hmm. Slash balcony.
Oh.
Rest in peace, Oak Tree Tavern.
Yeah, there's they're like something else now. I don't even know what it is.
Everything. Anyway, thanks for keeping me honest, Luke.
Always.
What would I do without you?
What would you do?
That's how I know. That's how I know I'm getting back to normal. Getting a little bit of, a little bit of pedantry from Luke.
Everyone needs a little patio on the back every now and again.
That's right. I think it's balcony on the back.
Yeah, that's right. Balcony on the back.
But
that's going to be on a t-shirt one day. That's one of our t-shirts. Balcony on the back. That's a deep cut. We know when we meet a fan with a tattoo that says balcony on the back, we know they're in there. They're in every episode.
Fans, the call has been made. All right. Well, more good news. We have actual factual horror movie information to share this week that it seems like, you know, the early season dip has ended and there's lots of movie news to choose from. So I am excited to share some of these stories. The first one, very in our wheelhouse, is the subtitle for the fifth Insidious movie has been given a different name. So it used to be called Insidious. I think not the last key, or
that was the fourth one.
That was the fourth one. I already don't remember what the old one was.
Insidious 5, coming home.
Yeah, Insidious 5.
It's not that.
Lipstick Face Demon rides again. No, it's called Insidious 5, The Red Door. So what do we think about that? Luke, you're our foremost Insidious lore expert, having seen all the films. We're still one behind you.
That's right.
So what do you think?
Well, the red door is prominent in the first Insidious film, so I imagine it's that red door being
is
referenced.
It? Well, there's a red door in the first one?
Yeah. Like in at least like five or six shots.
A red door. I don't think so. I've seen that movie. I don't think so.
Yeah. All right. Well, I mean, it could be that red door, but it also could be a different red door. That's all I can
say.
Is it
like the red door in Lipstick Face Demon's
it's like
tavern?
It's the door to his lair.
Yeah.
Okay. I just didn't remember the color and I didn't remember there was a door, but sure. Yeah. Right. The red door,
but
of course.
You remembered that Lipstick Face Demon has a famous tavern, of course.
Yeah, the tavern.
It's in like several of Josh's projections that happen before he actually goes into the further in Insidious. It's like in his dreams. And then also it's in the scene where he's fighting that one other demon that has shown up a lot to try and take the baby.
Right, right, right.
When he
trench coat.
Yeah, when he fights the trench coat guy, the trench coat guy is defending the red door. So.
Yeah, he's a bouncer. Let's give him that name. Canonically, the bouncer.
The bouncer.
Yeah, I don't remember any of this, but okay.
Well, that's why I'm the resident expert.
Yeah. <That's> why. Yeah, and so that has been slated for July 7th. So coming up in a couple months here.
Awesome.
What do you think? Is that going to be make the trip to Castlegar for you, Luke, when it comes out?
Yeah, I could see it. We've talked a little bit about, like, are there any horror franchises that don't have a bad... And by bad, I mean like lower than average. They don't even have to be great. They just have to be like average or better. And I would say all four of the Insidious movies have been average or better. So it's like the only one out there that doesn't have a really bad entry in it of all the franchises. Mm-hmm. So I'm optimistic about that. I mean, I think you need at least four to be considered a franchise. So I can't even really call The Conjuring a franchise in the same way yet. It's a trilogy, you know? So
yeah, that's true.
I also play that game with like bands I like. Like, is there a band that has at least four albums where not even one album is bad? And I can only think of one as well. And to me, it's Rage Against the Machine. All four Rage albums are great. But like, they're just, that's the minimum.
You liked Rage?
I do.
Is Rage, that the name of the fourth one? Rage?
Well, they had a self-titled one. And
what's
and,
that fourth one called with like the letters?
Oh, well, that was Renegades
though,
of Funk.
Right? That's it.
Renegades
that's
of Funk.
You like Renegades
that
of
was
Funk?
Like their kind of cover album. But it was great. It was really good.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Cool.
So, yeah, I'm excited.
Insidious.
For it.
I just pulled up the article here. This is from ihorror.com. And it was originally titled Insidious Fear of the Dark. So it's going to be Insidious the Red Door. And it says that the red doors serve as gateways to the layers of the franchise's most sinister villains and as portals to the further itself. So yeah, I think I remember talking about the red door and Tyson, what was his kid's name? Ty Simpkins, I know, is the actor, but I can't remember.
Dalton.
Dalton.
Tyson. Tyson Dalton.
Tyson Dalton Simpkins. He also, yeah, had a thing. Don't go in the red door. And so it's going to be Insidious Goes to College, which I think should be fun. And
didn't Harold and Kumar are going to be in it?
I hope Harold and Kumar are there. Maybe they're like, they used to work with Tucker and Spex.
Yeah.
And they split ways and now they have to come back together.
Yeah.
And maybe Ryan Reynolds.
One of them went to go work with Obama.
Yeah. Maybe one of them went to work with Obama. Anyway, if you're listening, Lee Winnell or Patrick Wilson, and you need an idea for Insidious 6, get Harold and Kumar. I'm sure if this movie does well, there will be a sixth one if they can get Patrick Wilson is involved.
I'm sure this movie will do well.
Is Vera Farmiga going to be in it? Or is it just Patrick Wilson?
She's not in that one.
She's in The Conjuring? See, these two just... Rose Byrne, that's the one. Is Rose Byrne going to be in this one?
Yes.
Awesome.
Yeah. It's going to be Patrick Wilson, Rose Byrne, Ty Simpkins. Probably there'll be another kid playing the younger siblings if they're in it. I know they had a little baby girl, and then there was Dalton's brother was even like a littler kid. So maybe that kid's back, but I can't... I mean, maybe the babies
that'd
be
pretty cool.
The little one. Maybe they're also back.
Well, because she'd be like 13 now.
Yeah, you know? She would be.
Yeah.
I mean, usually babies, like, as actors are usually twins or triplets or something, so, you know.
I can almost bet money that it's going to be a different human being.
Well, I mean, that's just statistically likely, but that's why it's a good bet, I guess.
Yeah, so put your money where your statistics are.
Well, it depends on the odds.
Yeah.
Depends on the odds.
Depends on that. Never tell me them. We gotta move on. Okay. All right. So that's Insidious 5. Anything else you want to add, Alex? Or
no?
You excited about that one? No.
Sure. Yeah. I'm really looking forward to Conjuring 4. The Insidious 5.
Conjuring 4. Insidious 5.
So like the family transports into The Conjuring, and Patrick Wilson plays both Ed and Josh. That'd be good.
Yeah, it's like a cool Spider-Verse kind of moment.
It's gotta go together. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it needs to. This is not the article I found.
Oh, okay.
Oh, here we go. Okay, this one is called, again, coming out this year in August. We've got The Last Voyage of the Demeter, which has been in production hell for a while, but it is...
Like the Greek made. Goddess of farming?
That is what the ship is based off of, but this book is,
that's
Theseus. I believe... only eventually. Only to a point.
Okay.
This one is The Last Voyage of the Demeter, so-called because it was the name of the ship that transported Dracula from his Eastern European stronghold into London, I believe. And so it's the story of what happened on that ship, because in the book, in Dracula, it just sort of shows up as a ghost ship and everyone's been killed. And so it's kind of a spin-off or an expansion of something that happens in the Dracula novel. So what do we think about that? The Last Voyage of the Demeter.
I don't know anything about Dracula lore. Dracula lore, so.
It's Draculore.
Draculore. So I'm indifferent on it.
Indifferent. Luke, you familiar?
I have to say, at this point in the month, my give a shit a meter about vampires is pretty low, so. I'm sure I'll care about it more in August.
But Luke, it's only the second week of Vampire Month.
Well, I'll have more energy for the other weeks.
Sure.
Are you gonna watch the Nick Cage, Nick Holt vampire movie?
That one is...
It feels
Redfield?
More like a comedy than a vampire movie. I'm sure it'll be I'll watch it one day when it comes on streaming and nothing else looks good. I feel like that's...
Yeah.
That movie kind of seems like it'll fit into that one.
I saw a... tweet or an article or Instagram post or something where apparently that movie is a direct sequel to 1931's Dracula. Mm. So Nick Holt is playing Renfield from that movie. Nick Cage is playing the Bela Lugosi Dracula. But it's set in the modern day. So I don't know. I thought Dracula died at the end of 1931's Dracula. I guess, spoiler alert, maybe he didn't, but I don't know. It seems interesting.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That is true.
Sorry. You gotta fill in my my giant gaps where I need to cough. I mean, I know I can edit it out, but... Okay, well, so vampires were pretty cool on now. I get it. I've got one more news story for you and a question. What would you say, if you think back to irrational things that children were afraid of in the 90s, what is, maybe not the number one thing, but what is something that a lot of people seem to be irrationally afraid of back then?
Y2K.
Not what I was thinking, but yes, we were irrationally afraid of that.
Child abduction?
Yeah, I guess kids could, but more like if you were a kid. A lot of kids held this very, very irrational fear. Maybe not parents, but like as a child, something that we were very, very terrified of without any reason or any like expectation that we would experience this phenomenon.
Chicken pox.
Chicken pox. Okay.
Getting hit by a car.
You're going too literal.
Monsters in the dark. I don't know.
Monsters in the dark. That's a big one. Alex, any guesses?
I don't know. I can't think of anything like exclusively 90s scary, you know?
Goosebumps?
You said 90s, right?
Are you afraid of
maybe
the dark?
That's, those maybe that's a mislead. I apologize for that being a mislead. This is more of like a natural phenomenon that it found that I know I counted myself amongst the kids that were irrationally
scared. A natural
of this
phenomenon.
Happening to them. Yes, a natural phenomenon.
Oh, like an earthquake?
Oh, global warming.
Earthquake, global warming. No. Okay.
Like
now, I kind of want to see where this goes.
Earthquakes,
volcanoes.
No, not earthquakes. Volcanoes is getting closer, but
we might say it's getting hotter.
Clearly, my clue leaving is leaves something to be desired. But I'm talking about the fear of getting stuck in quicksand. Was that not something people were like afraid of happening to them when they were kids?
Oh yeah,
I know. No. I was always like.
God. Where am I going to find quicksand in Calgary, Alberta?
That's the irrational part.
Oh my gosh. Oh yeah, definitely a 90s thing.
I remember, I think it's because, you know, Bugs Bunny cartoons or other shows like that always seem to have like a little quicksand scene where somebody would like step in or sink or...
Yeah, but they'd get out every single time. Have you ever actually seen anyone die to quicksand? That's the question.
They never film those.
That's true.
They never film those. So
it's always
there's like 100% survival rate of quicksand.
Okay.
Unless you're a bad guy. True, but... If you're a bad guy, you could die in the quicksand.
You could die in the quicksand. Well, anyway, there's a movie coming out on Shudder in June called Quicksand, which I think will maybe reignite some of those irrational fears. It's a survival thriller called Quicksilver.
Is it going to be like 127 hours where it's just one guy quicksand, with one camera in quicksand for like 2 hours?
No, it's going to be the story. Here's the story from Variety.com. A married couple on the brink of divorce who become trapped in quicksand while hiking through a Colombian rainforest. It is a struggle for survival as they battle the elements of the jungle and must work together in order to escape. So
that sounds terrible. Imagine like being stuck divorce. In quicksand with someone you're going to divorce.
If we get out of this, the divorce is still on.
It's a metaphor. The whole movie's a
metaphor. Maybe that's like the best survival method, right? Like, I'm going to get out of this quicksand just to spite you.
Well, there we go.
It's the best motivation.
The best motivation.
Here's a thought. Don't get married to someone you're going to feel spite for one day.
Okay, mind reader.
I agree.
I don't know. Save some fucking time. Don't get caught in that quicksand. The quicksand of life, if you will. Avoid it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Or sometimes, sometimes I see people getting married and they're like, well... It's just what we have to do because, you know, we're supposed to. And it's like, that doesn't sound like a great reason.
No.
You know, I am excited. It's got, you know, Colombian stars, Colombian actors. It was filmed in Colombia, which is cool. And I love to see a good rainforest movie.
I believe it's pronounced Colombia.
Yes, Colombia, not Colombia. All right. Well, thought this was going to go different. I thought everybody.
Everybody was scared of quicksand? No.
Quicksand. I guess. Fuck me, right?
Well, it's a good lesson on the application of clues. for a particular thing.
Yeah, this was a 90s specific fear.
Pogs? Getting hit in the face with a slammer? I don't know. Oh, I know. Fucking Power Rangers not being real. That was scary.
That's right. Yeah. There's a new horror movie that reveals the fact that Power Rangers aren't real. It's real scary.
Oh, God.
Oh, no.
The scariest thing of the 90s is that all that great shit is just lost forever.
I mean, have you been on the internet? It's pretty much like you can find it. You can find
but it's just not shared in the same way. I mean, that's I have a broader perspective on the socio.
I'll say it. 90s nostalgia sucks ass. That's right. I'm brave.
Alex is chronically allergic to nostalgia, as we know. It's the here and now. It's modern things. No looking back. That's why Alex doesn't have a rearview mirror.
That's right.
It's for looking back. Alex is a very safe driver, listeners. All right. Well, let's look forward to discussing this week's movie then. How's that sound?
Sure.
Can't wait.
All right. And then we talk about a vampire movie that Alex picked for the month. So, Alex, what movie have you picked for us?
So, this week I picked Kronos without the H. Took me a while to figure that out. It is a Mexican movie directed by Guillermo del Toro. Yes, the Guillermo del Toro himself.
Yes, that one.
I Googled vampire movies and outside of like the very obvious ones, this was one that like popped up on a lot of well-received lists that it got me interested because I know of Guillermo del Toro. I don't know him personally, but I know of him. And I generally enjoy his movies. They're pretty good.
Yeah.
And it seemed like a lot of the reviews were like interesting and unique take on the vampire genre. I was like, okay, let's do that.
Not wrong. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I picked Kronos, not knowing anything about it other than it's Guillermo del Toro and may or may not have vampires.
Which is a question we can definitely debate after the trailer. Yeah, I was also, maybe this is a bit of a spoiler, but it's surprising that this movie would come up on a list if you Googled vampire movies, because it's a lot of connecting the dots, I think. I would say
it is a vampire movie, though, right?
It has the distinction of being a vampire movie where nobody, not even one person one time, says the word vampire at all. So I didn't know anything about it. I'm a huge fan of Guillermo del Toro. I'm excited for his take on Frankenstein that he's working on currently. That's got some cool people attached to it. I like Pan's Labyrinth. I liked Pacific Rim. That was a wonderful film. And so seeing Guillermo del Toro's first theatrical movie, sure, let's do it. I'm in. So I was excited that you picked it. And it's always nice to have a movie that I know nothing, absolutely nothing about to watch. But Luke, what did you know about this one? Or is this a new one for you too?
Yeah, I had never heard of it, but I was going in no idea at all other than there's probably a vampire because of Vampire Month. I was meta aware of this film given our category of this month.
Yes.
But I feel like by the first minute that you watch the movie, it's like, oh yeah, there's vampires. Or vampire.
Well, I knew it a minute before, so.
Damn.
I had a minute head start on the movie.
A minute's head start, yeah. So yeah, if somebody just out of the blue was like, hey Luke, or maybe this is one for other Alex, if other Alex was like, hey, we're gonna watch Kronos for Full Spectrum Cinema and you didn't do it this one, it wouldn't lead you to think vampire necessarily.
No. Until maybe a minute into the movie.
Maybe a minute in. Yeah.
Yeah.
Minute and a half if you're slow.
So I knew it a bit faster on this podcast.
Yes. Yes. All right. Well,
glad we spelled that out for the listeners.
Yes. Spelled. That's what we do. That's what we do best. So, yeah, why don't we get into it? Here's the trailer for Kronos. Just kidding. There's no trailer with dialogue that I could find on the internet. So here's Alex.
Kronos is a 1992 Mexican independent horror drama film written and directed by Guillermo del Toro and starring Federico Lupi and Ron Perlman. Kronos is Del Toro's first feature film. A mysterious device designed to provide its owner with eternal life resurfaces after 400 years, leaving a trail of destruction in its path. I don't really agree with that synopsis. A trail of destruction is subjective.
It's not if you consider statues of archangels being destroyed as a trail of destruction.
Yeah. Might be overstating the case a bit.
There might be a car as well, you know.
A couple cars, a couple factories.
Some signs.
Yeah, some signs. Okay, Alex, give us your first thoughts about this. I can't wait to talk about this movie. This is such an interesting one, and I can't wait to hear what you say.
It's very unique. I think it's like, I would say, like, right off the bat, it's not necessarily a scary horror movie. Like, probably wasn't scared at all in this movie. But it brings that kind of fantasy, dark, gothic, emotional feel that I think Guillermo del Toro is really, really good at, like in Pan's Labyrinth and Shape of Water, you know, like really good at having just some weird shit happen, but making it oddly emotional. If I were to compare this to another vampire movie, I think it felt very, very much like Let the Right One In.
Ooh, yes. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Like where it's like, it's kind of a vampire movie. It's not very scary, but it's got really cool characters and kind of deep emotional value at points. I thought it was an interesting spin on vampires where, like you said earlier, they say the word vampire zero times, but it's got, and it doesn't have like their typical vampire transformation where in order to become a vampire, you get bitten by another vampire, but instead mm-hmm. it's this little device. The yeah. Kronos that was made by an alchemist that injects you with something that makes you a vampire, but in order to stay as a vampire, you got to drink blood. There were very loose rules in this movie.
Oh boy.
Which was funny because there was a very big and descriptive notebook about all the rules, but you don't really learn anything about that.
But they really wave that notebook around and don't ever open it too much.
Yeah, but I think the point of the movie is less so the vampires and the rules, but more so the human element of, like, the human condition and humanity itself and valuing life and death and what's important to you. I quite enjoyed it, but it is definitely, I wouldn't call it a horror movie at all.
Yeah, this is definitely more in the drama side of it, and I was really impressed with the film overall. I don't know, I really like Guillermo del Toro's stuff. I've noticed this theme that he has in a lot of his movies, where it's very, like, relationship focused and like a found family type of scenario. It's not directly like a one-to-one parent and child relationship necessarily, but there's a lot of, like, you know, surrogates or, like, you know, adoptions type of thing. Like in this movie, there's a little kid at the center of it, and she's being raised by her grandparents, and we don't really know what happened to her parents. And in Pan's Labyrinth, you know, the little girl Ophelia is, you know, she's in a step parent situation in fascist Spain, so not great. You know, even like in Pacific Rim, a movie where there's giant robots fighting giant monsters, there's like a relationship between Idris Elba's character and like one of the Jaeger drivers who's like, he adopted her when she was younger, and there's like a kind of like he's got all these things. Like Pinocchio is a really clear example, of course, with Geppetto and like this wooden boy who is his child. And so I really think that Guillermo del Toro has this like family mode that he goes into, and that the drama at the heart of that was very interesting. And then it was nice to see Ron Perlman show up. You know, he's a staple of a del Toro film.
Not just Ron Perlman, a young Ron Perlman.
A very young Ron Perlman. And he was having fun. I really enjoyed this film, and I can't wait to get into more in-depth discussions about it, but I want to hear from Luke Mason.
I think this film has a lot of merit. There's a lot of cool art direction, and the prosthetics used later in the film to reveal the vampire or non-vampire or whatever was pretty
Marvel
cool.
Marvel monster.
Yeah. Yeah. The archangel statues were nice. Like I enjoyed a lot of the antiques and all of that on set. And the cinematography was pretty captivating a lot of the time. There was some really cool ways of shooting shots that when you notice a shot is as being different than the norm, you're like, okay, yeah, there's some higher level cinematics going on here. But I do have to say I found this film pretty breathtakingly uneventful. Like, it was so boring yeah. to me that I kind of was on my phone the last 20 minutes more than watching it, sure. which in a movie with subtitles means I don't actually know if I know what happened at the end of this movie. So I might have to depend on the two of you to remind me or let me know, because I wasn't like the dialogue. I don't know. It kind of didn't captivate me. It was a little too slow and ponderous for my tastes. And I found the acting fairly hackneyed and just not, when you know they're acting versus their characters, you're like, okay. I have a hard time with that. And especially Ron Perlman, who, you know, I have a soft spot in my heart for him. I thought he was atrocious in this film as an actor. I think he was like so over the top and ridiculous that it just didn't land in the kind of funny way that someone could be an over-the-top actor for me. It landed in a kind of obnoxious, unbelievable way. So it kind of ripped me out of the narrative every time he said one word ever in this film.
Yeah.
But again, I mean, it looked cool. Not really a horror film, I would say. And I feel like Del Toro films are much more about the kind of themes and feelings than the plot, because the plot of this is, you know, a lot of coincidences and, oh, that's convenient kind of thing. So, you know, I enjoyed the kind of feelings, but I also do think the deeper themes are better explored in other films than in this one. I think he took a good swing at those themes in this film, but I just think, like, if I think about life extension or the philosophy of it, whatever the uncle is, to me is far inferior than like exploring those ideas in a film like Vanilla Sky or even the Peter Weyland character in the Alien franchise. Like, I think those kind of movies do that so much more intelligently than this movie did. And then the family stuff, yeah, it's nice. It's nice. But it was just, I don't know. I think it was all just a little bit too of a pacing that it just isn't to my taste.
I know what you mean, because it feels like there was more story there that made it on the screen. Like, there's more history behind why the family dynamic is the way it is, and what Jesus, who is the man who runs the antique shop, like, what his whole deal is with his granddaughter. There's more to be explored with Ron Perlman's character, like the characterization. Why is he working for his uncle in this capacity? Obviously, he wants to inherit his fortune, but you know, it's just like,
why does he outwardly monologue his own cynicism? Like, who's he talking
he's so cynical and fed up with caring for this guy, but he's also like really obsessed with like getting a nose job, which was a very strange character art. Like, there's just whole scenes of him turning to profile and holding up like nose cutouts to be like, eh, what do you think? And it's just like, okay, there's some character Bible where this is all laid out, but you didn't bring that in front of the camera. You just sort of talked about it off screen. And I was kind of fascinated that way in terms of his like rage and cynicism. I totally vibed with his being called away for his uncle and just like swearing off mic before like switching into like customer service voice and just being like, ah, oh, you fucking stupid old man, I hate you. Click. Yes, uncle, I'll be right there. Like, I found that to be a good touch, even if he was over the top. And I really liked the choice or the decision that was made that he wasn't speaking Spanish and the other people were, and so it was like a multilingual movie. I thought it was going to be subtitles the whole time. I thought it was going to be entirely in Spanish, much in the way Pan's Labyrinth is, but just having a mix of languages, I don't know, made it feel more like, I guess, more like the real world, where not necessarily everybody in a scene is always going to be speaking the same thing, and people can still understand each other. So that was cool. But yeah, I can see where you're coming from, where he's just like so over the top and like wacky.
Well, it wasn't
and
just then, him either. The uncle too was like that.
Yeah, I thought he was. He gave me Denethor vibes. Like, he gave me low key Denethor vibes from Lord of the Rings.
But I would just say it was hard. It was. I had a hard time believing their relationship because they were just both so type A.
Yeah.
About everything. It's like, how are these people?
They're such reds, am I right?
Yeah. They're two reds. Two red characters. I mean, but that's not unbelievable that there's family dynamics where you are kind of obligated to care for somebody who is unpleasant in some way.
Yeah, no. Dynamics I didn't buy. It was the acting. I just think the acting itself was what drew me out of the narrative.
Sure.
And that happens in lots of films. Like, not
right.
This is not a unique film in that. You know, it's one of the main bugaboos of filmmaking is you can have a great writing, great story, great dynamic, but if the acting is just not there, it's because it's so visceral, right?
Yeah. 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 Well, I might as well finish off my thoughts on Ron Perlman's character as we go through, but maybe Luke, you won't be able to help us out because the very end of the movie was confusing to you, but maybe Alex might be leaning on you. It didn't make much sense to me that at the very end, Angel, who is Ron Perlman's character, essentially gets what he wants. His uncle is dead. He's inherited the will. And then he's just like, I'm still going to kill this other guy who's in here who has nothing to do with me. And, you know,
and also can't take die.
And can't die, but like threaten him and fight him and be violent and aggressive towards him, even though like he's won. So I didn't know what his character was trying to do there or what that commentary was.
Yeah, I didn't really get it either, because it felt like all the shit that Ron Perlman did to Jesus and was from his uncle's commands, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then it's like, uncle's gone now, but I'm still going to carry out your commands.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you don't have to, he's dead, but maybe it's because he got hit with the pole at the very end, and he's like,
oh, maybe.
No, I got hit by a pole. Like, he got hit in the face one more time, right?
Right.
And like, no, now the nose job is completely off the table because I don't even have a nose anymore.
He got his nose broken twice in this movie, and that was his bridge too far. Yeah.
Good one.
Thanks. I'd love to claim that was on purpose, but no, no, no.
No one will know unless you say.
No one will know. I got lucky. I got lucky. I'm admitting it. Okay, well, let's talk about Jesus. Jesus Gris, who is the protagonist. And one thing that I'll say right off the top that I was really disappointed by is I thought they were going to do more de-aging of him. Like, he gets this Chronos device that's supposed to help him live super long. And in the first scene, he's an old man with a vest that's buttoned up and a bow tie and a mustache. And then he's like, now I'm getting younger. Time to shave my mustache. Not wearing a bow tie anymore. And then that was it. I thought they're going to go back more, give him like darker hair, have him stand up straight, like change his physicality. But it was just like, nah, I'm just not buttoning my vest anymore because that's what young, cool guys do. I thought that was really weird.
Yeah, I thought the de-aging part of him was a lot more physically manifested than visually, you know, like just the way he moved was younger and the way he presented himself and talked to people. But yeah, I thought they would have de-aged him more, but I guess if he's already that old, it's hard to make someone look younger. I don't know.
I guess so. Maybe he was already like in his 50s as an actor. But yeah. And Marvel comics movies haven't come out yet, so
yeah, they can't use that. They didn't have that Marvel money or tech.
That was years away. But yeah, so he's our, I guess, vampire in this movie. He finds the Chronos device, and it, you know, he sees that it opens up into six legs that have a needle on the end of it and is like, it's a good idea to keep holding this in my bare hand, and then gets like bit by it a whole bunch of times. So that sort of way of turning you into a vampire, I have to say, is never seen that before in any other vampire.
So what was it? Was it like a bug inside the Chronos device that had like some kind of, because it looked like there was something living in there, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it was some sort of insect that the alchemist built a cage for. And because the uncle has this whole thing where he's like, you know, ants and flies can live inside of, you know, in stasis for hundreds of years. No, they can't, but okay. But like, just like I don't know, it was just some sort of bug that had like a really long lifespan and fed off human blood and got a little sweet mech armor suit built for him by an alchemist 400 years ago. And I wanted to see more of that gross bug on the inside, because it looked like there was something going on there when it went onto the inside of the machine. But yeah, I think it was just a bug.
It was cool design, though.
It was very cool. It was
very Yu-Gi-Oh-esque, you know?
Yeah.
Very, it's the Yu-Gi-Oh. Millennium Scarab.
Very,
Sorry, I don't know if either of you would get that reference. That's more of a me thing.
That's more of a you thing. I know the only thing I know from Yu-Gi-Oh is blue eyes, white dragon. That's it.
It's a junior millennial cultural reference.
A junior, yeah. We're all elder millennials. But I like that, you know, his the construction of this device was all like gold and very sort of like a marrying of biological and mechanical and like gears and sprockets, which is something we've seen with Del Toro for everything since. So it was really nice to see this first attempt and see all the seeds of like what Del Toro is kind of known for, like his stuff. And Hellboy is very much the same, like steampunky wheels and cogs on top of somebody's like top hat or something. But yeah, I thought it was a cool design. What you got on the Scarab? Millennium Scarab? Is that what you called it, Alex?
Millennium.
Luke?
I mean, I didn't find it any more bizarre or unbelievable than any other reason why monsters exist in these films. It was as equally nonsensical as all the other reason. The because demons version of everything. So right. We can put that on the bingo card of why this happened.
Okay, but
all the different things in the movies for what creates the monsters or why they are there. A bug that sucks your blood in a machine. That's fine.
How about the kind of the unconventional take on vampires, though? Because like vampires are created by being bit by other vampires. I feel like almost every vampire movie is like that. I can't think of any exception. So in this one, it's man-made in some way because it's like a machine or like a tool. Mm-hmm. So I think
the lore is that this alchemist 400 years ago found this bug that was like a magic life forever bug and put it in the device and kept it safe. And it like just through interacting with it, it like bit him and fed off his blood. And so he, I guess to make up for the loss of blood that the bug was drinking, he had to like replenish it somehow. And that leads him to drinking the blood. Yeah, I think that was it. I think just the bug turning you into a vampire by depleting your blood was a very weird thing. And it didn't seem like he could, you know, spread the virus to other people and turn them into vampires. It seemed just like the threat to other people from him would have been just him killing them and drinking their blood. And we see that at the end when his granddaughter is like bleeding and he's got this, you know, compulsion to try to, you know, attach the Kronos device, and then we assume he's fighting the urge to kill her and drink her blood, and he smashes it with a rock, which seems like, I don't know, 400 years? Probably that would have gotten smashed by or something before then, but...
Yeah, I think that was like, that was the big kind of humanity approach of the movie, where, you know, whereas the uncle, I'm sure he had a name, I just don't remember it, was hell-bent on, like, destruction and doing whatever it takes to live forever. You know, Jesus, he kind of stumbled upon it accidentally. And I think he, you know, through conversations that he had with Aurora and, you know, in that letter that he's writing to his wife, he realizes, like, he seemed like a pretty devout Catholic. So it's like, whatever God has for me will happen. And then he's like, all right, I'll break this thing so that, you know, I'm not going to live with that. Like, I think he knows he won't live without it. Yeah. And he won't live without blood. And then he decides to, like, I don't know, as the very last scene in the movie, the sun's rising, right? So he's just like letting fate decide whether or not he dies or not, right? But he's doing it around the people he cares about, his wife and his granddaughter.
Yeah, I thought it was a very sweet ending, actually, where he's, you know, he's given up his power to live forever, potentially, at great cost, and just sort of give over to the fate of it. And for some reason, I thought this movie was going to end with him burning in the sunrise, like St. Maud style, but no. They did get that part of vampire lore right, where he had sunlight sensitivity. Like, he's in the attic that's all full of holes, and it burns him, so he has to make his little, like, coffin out of a steamer trunk and sleep in there. But yeah, I think, in terms of horror, oh, the creature of the night stalking people and killing them and turning them into, like, slaves and thralls and familiars and stuff is just like, oh, I didn't want this. And I gotta get rid of it for the good of humanity and my family. Okay, well, since we're still on the topic of Jesus, the effects, the makeup of him, his like marble skin that he developed, what did we think of those effects? Luke, how'd you find the special effects and makeup in this movie?
Yeah, they were sufficiently gross, and then the white skin underneath was a cool touch, I think. So it was impressive.
Do you think they only ripped off part of his face because they ran out of budget?
Maybe,
possibly. I mean, it just didn't seem like a film that had a large budget to start with, so
no.
I guess that's possible.
I liked when he lifted up his shirt to see like his tummy skin. It was clearly he was just wearing like a onesie or like a leotard that had been dyed. It was just like a fabric sort of tank top underneath. And he's like, oh, no, my skin's all white and marbly.
Don't want to look at that anymore.
Oh, yeah, put your shirt down. Okay, good job. Yeah, I thought it looked cool. It was an interesting take. The fact that the alchemist, again, was somebody who was reported to have this alabaster, completely white marble skin.
White people, am I right?
Yeah, ooh, the real danger. Was funny. And actually, the makeup led to a part of the movie that was unexpectedly comedic for me, which I didn't see coming at all. But once Jesus dies, or they think he's dead, there's a very long scene in the mortician's office or the undertaker's office where they're getting him ready for a burial. And the dialogue is just like, oh man, I'm so good at making up these dead corpses to look like they're just sleeping, and it's so good. And it just looks like he's layering like sliced turkey breast on his forehead and just like trying to blend it all in. I don't know why. This art. Everyone was like, Tito, you're a master. You're so good at making dead people look like they're sleeping. And it was just, oh, I don't know. Face. Yeah, it was so
And then when he
silly.
Finds out that like he's getting cremated, he gets all like mad.
Yeah. Oh, that was the funniest part of the movie for me. He was like, oh, by the way, they're cremating this guy. And he's like, what? Are you kidding me? I spent all this time making this guy look nice. I didn't expect comedy to happen in this movie. And this very weird, morbid, gallows humor type of character of the mortician was, I don't know, a delightful surprise to me. Anything else on the makeup for you, Alex?
Yeah, I had a question. Like, what's up with the uncle's hands? Were they his real hands? Why'd they look like that?
I thought he was wearing gloves, wasn't he? Oh. Like, he seemed like he was in gloves and booties. He was in this, like, safe room or this, like, germ-free zone or whatever. I made a joke that Ron Perlman was visiting his uncle in April of 2020, the pandemic. But, it seemed like they were trying to keep germs out, even though so many times Ron Perlman would take his mask off in the middle of conversation, or
when Jesus is visiting the uncle for the first time, and he's like, "You need to leave," and then Ron Perlman comes in and just drops his shoes on the ground. Like, what was the point of him wearing the booties?
Yeah, why did you make him wear the booties and then just drop the shoes right on the ground in this scene? I mean, maybe Ron Perlman just doesn't care that much about his uncle, and he's like, "Yeah, sure, no, I'll wear the mask," and just like puts it on his forehead a couple times. But yeah, it seemed uneven, and maybe that's where some of the acting choices and unevenness came from for you, Luke. But
maybe,
I don't know, any thoughts on Uncle and his little walking canes and his little gloves?
Yeah, he surprisingly had a lot of strength for a man who's dying too.
I know,
and seemed to only eat pills. All he ate was pills.
But it found some of them more tasty than others.
Yes.
You know?
The red ones are especially good today. I thought he was eating Skittles.
Pure pill diet.
I don't know. I found both villain characters in this film to be kind of unacceptably stereotypical, I guess. Mm-hmm. Like, they were just too much of what you expect a bad guy to be, I guess. They're like too cynical, too obnoxious, too over the top, too conniving, too Machiavellian without it. Like, and all those attributes are perfectly fine in a villain, but you just can't make it obvious. It has to be revealed through really good narrative. So like, probably other than obnoxious, I think all of those attributes could probably be given to like Anton Chigurh from No Country for Old Men or something like that. But he doesn't just blast it out to the world, right? Mm. Like you observe it through decisions that a character makes that we get privy to because we're the audience watching right. what they're doing that the other characters in the film don't have privileged access to. And I just didn't understand. I mean, maybe it's just the runtime didn't allow for more subtle ways of revealing what these characters want. But they're just kind of like yelling it on a marquee.
Comedically evil, you know?
Yeah, they're like yelling it on a marquee. I was like, okay, yeah, I get it. You suck.
I wonder,
you're still sucking.
I wonder, yeah. I wonder if this is maybe a result of like this being a first time at the behind the camera for Del Toro. Like, you know, totally like possible. His craft is yet unformed. He's finding his feet. He's finding his subtleties, and it takes him a while to develop it. Yeah.
Who is the villain in Pan's Labyrinth? Like the
he's like
I know who it was, but like what was his role? He was like the stepfather, right?
He was a stepfather. He was a general in the Franco regime.
Yeah. He's
a bad guy.
That character is one of the most terrifying villains in any movie, I would say.
So bad, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So improvement has happened.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. And it's nice to see that, again, like I said, like the seeds of what Del Toro would sort of grow into and some of the themes that would mature through other films is fascinating to see him start here. Mm-hmm. And just be like, oh, you're going to do some great things. Like, this was a little rough. This is a bit janky. Not all of this landed, but one day you're going to make Pacific Rim. And what a film that will be.
That will be sick.
Did he make the second one too?
No.
No.
He did not make the second one, which is too bad because Pacific Rim is a movie. We're going to talk about Pacific Rim for a bit, folks. Just deal with it. Pacific Rim was a movie that I didn't hear anything about when it was coming out, and I saw it during a break during performances on Stampede Week, back when I was performing at Stampede Week, and it was like the hottest day in July. People were like, we're going to go see a movie. It's called Pacific Rim, and I was just like, I've never heard of this movie. Let's go see it. And just like monsters fighting robots in an air-conditioned theater in the middle of July, you're just like, I'm like, wow, cinema is magic. Like, I don't know what was.
We did it.
Holy shit, that movie's so good.
We did it.
It was that movie and Role Models that are two that I mention as being completely surprising movies that I didn't see coming and loving the hell out of. So, anyway, back to Kronos. What did you think about this being a Christmas movie? Is it going to make your December watches going forward?
This was a Christmas movie?
Yeah, happened at Christmas time and New Year's.
I've missed that too, I guess.
The entire set piece at the party is set during a New Year's Eve countdown. Mm. You know, and he's like in the bathroom and trying not to drink the blood that's on the sink. That's all a New Year's party. Like they're having a big gala.
Also, okay, what the fuck was up with the guy that cleaned up the sink counter? He's clearly peeing. He comes out of the stall.
Yeah.
He's done peeing. He notices there's blood on the counter. So mm-hmm. he wets his hand a little bit and like tries to brush some of the blood off the counter into the sink.
Yeah.
He doesn't do a good job. It's not cleaned. There's still blood all over the sink mm-hmm. and he didn't wash his hands.
Yeah.
That was the most bizarre part of the movie.
A really weird drunk interaction that I don't know. It's such a low point for Jesus in the movie because he's trying to fight this urge of drinking this blood. And another person at the party has a nosebleed and drips all over the sink. And he's just like, oh, I'm gonna drink this blood. And you see that he's like fighting it. And then eventually he gives in. And just as he gives in, this fucking guy shows up just angrily wipe all the blood down the sink. And yeah, I don't know what his plan was. Didn't look like he was in charge of cleaning the bathroom. He just looked like he was annoyed that the bathroom was dirty. And then
he made it dirtier.
He made it worse and left with his own pee and someone else's blood on his hands. Probably to go back out to, like, party. But then we got to see the even lower fall of him by having to lick the blood off the bathroom floor, which...
That was the grossest part of the movie for me.
didn't like that.
I did not like that.
But then that scene finishes again in a very confusing way where he's on the floor. We get a shot of him, just his face, and he gets kicked in the head by Angel, Ron Perlman's character. But there's no indication that he's been at this party the whole time. So it's very just like, oh, where did you come from? Just like uneven again and kind of feels like they cut out scenes that would have made it make sense for him to be there. Aside from him just like loosely following him around. Do you remember the New Year's party now, Luke? Remember that bit?
Yeah, I just didn't, I guess it didn't register as a New Year's party.
Sure. Fair. Fair enough. It really didn't grab your attention, hey?
I really have to be honest. This movie was like, I had to work really hard to pay attention to things going on in this film.
That's fair. That's fair. We all get like that. We all have times like that. Okay, let's see what else we can talk about. My notes, I don't know why I keep taking notes. They are not helpful, and they're all just like me pointing at things that are happening right on the screen, and then I look back later and review them, and I go like, I don't remember what that was talking about. So my note-taking is not great. Did either of you think that Aurora, his granddaughter, was going to get like bitten by the Kronos machine? Did you think that was coming?
I did.
No.
I thought the scene where she was hiding behind the blanket, she'd already turned.
Oh.
Or had been bitten.
See, that would have made an interesting twist in the movie, right? Because then not only is he trying to protect Aurora, but he's like, if he doesn't want her to die, he got to find blood for her, you know?
Yeah.
You know what? They should remake this movie and have her get bit.
That would have been a more like Hollywood choice. And that doesn't really seem like what Del Toro was going for, other than a big fight scene at the end.
True. Although I will say that her acting during that scene was great, where she's like hiding behind a curtain. She's not doing a good job. He can clearly see her feet, and he's found her. And she just stays behind the curtain, being like, nope, I'm still hiding, until he pours her a little cup of tea, which she accepts, and then goes back to hiding. You're just like, oh, yeah, okay, little kids, like, I get it.
That was actually my favorite scene in the whole movie, when he talks about her dad. He's like, you probably don't remember, do you? So, like, that gives a little bit of background. Like,
yeah,
clearly her dad died when she was very young. And he talks about how, like, when the dad found out when he was younger that cigarettes give you cancer, he like threw out all his cigarettes, and it was like a nice kind of like it was
a very heartwarming scene.
It was because it was like Aurora knew that, you know, that Kronos device was not good for Jesus, but and decided to hide it, and then he was able to relate it to her and understand why she did it, but then also get it back. And, you know, connect with her a little bit and give a bit of backstory. That was my favorite scene in the movie.
Yeah, that's like the part I'm talking about, with the sweetness of this movie and the relationship between him and Aurora. Just the whole opening scene where she goes to work with him. She goes to open up the antique shop and she's just hanging out with him. Like, I really thought the scenes of them two together was very sweet and very lovely. And you just really felt like these two people have a great relationship. It's maybe not what either of them wanted, but they're making the best of it, and they have like a great time. Like, you know, she's got little jobs at the antique shop. She has to like change the calendar date and help him, whatever, open up stuff. And he's making a puzzle with her. It's just like, ah, oh, I like that. I like that a lot. Oh, okay. Here's a question, which both of you can help me answer. Do you think there is a significance to the Kronos device being hid in an archangel statue versus like a regular angel statue? Is there any sort of Christian lore or biblical lore around the containing of an evil thing inside of an archangel? Or
what's the difference between an archangel and an angel? Rank. This is not a joke. Rank?
Rank. Can you get promoted from angel to archangel?
Archangels are like the top angels. Archangels get to tell other angels what to do.
That's Mr. Archangel to you.
Mr. Manager. We just say Archangel. Say Mr. Archangel. Okay, so they're just like more angel. They're like better at angel.
More angel.
They're like the most important ones. They're the ones that, like, as far as I know, it's always been an archangel that has come to talk to humans. Mm. So like Michael or Gabriel are the two examples that come to mind. Now, it's possible there's parts of the Bible where lower rank angels come and talk, and even in Islam, it's the Archangel Gabriel that comes and relates to Muhammad what becomes the Quran, right? And so it's basically, I imagine they get their rank so that they can like kind of mediate between heaven and earth. So the archangels in the Bible are the mediators between, like, because I mean, there are stories in the Old Testament how God directly speaks to some of the prophets, but a lot of the times it's mediated through one of the archangels.
Yeah, I think, from what I've seen, it's like you never actually get a one-on-one with God. It's like Michael will come and talk to you and be like, hey, here's what God said.
Okay, so to answer your question, maybe it's just like the link between humanity and immortality is through an archangel.
Ah.
Wow, that's so fucking deep.
So deep. Yeah. Well, and who's to say that weird bug might not be God? Who knows?
It's not really something this movie explored much, or in the extent that it did, it just kind of was on the surface level. But I mean, there's a lot of lore and history around the transition from the pre-scientific to the scientific age. Alchemy was the idea of turning lead into gold, but it's also the precursor for chemistry. Astrology is the precursor for astronomy. And that boundary line between a pre-scientific and a scientific understanding. I mean, in the pre-scientific world, especially the kind of medieval Renaissance pre-scientific world, there's a lot of lore around the elixir of life, energy, pure
animism.
The philosopher's
stone. Yeah.
The philosopher's stone, all that kind of stuff. Blood, obviously, being an important part of this movie, was also an important part of all of that. Like, the blood is the life force energy, and I don't know what, like, symbolic representation this movie's trying to have with any of that, but it is kind of interesting to see how, like, a lot of these pre-scientific stories, though they themselves are incorrect, factually do point groups of people towards studying them more to get more understanding out of them and that kind of thing. And
yeah.
So maybe alchemy was a necessary incorrect step for chemistry, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Does alchemy still exist as a thing where, like, not in the sense of like, ooh, we're gonna like, but like, do you think like there are like chemists out there that are trying to find like the properties of atoms that can transform atoms into other atoms?
I think most alchemy nowadays is historically viewed and sort of talking about the context of it. I don't know. I feel like if somebody was exploring the way of changing atoms by adding protons or neutrons or electrons or whatever into different things, that would not necessarily be classified as alchemy anymore, but just
experimental chemistry.
Yeah, can you imagine like a PhD in chemistry goes on their business card and just says alchemist.
Yeah, I mean, what really is different between alchemy and chemistry is the method used to determine what's happening. And so
rigorous nowadays.
Yeah, like to be a true alchemist, you would just have to not use any scientific method in the atoms, which I don't even know how you could know anything about atoms without using a scientific method. So I think it's like a non-starter almost. The level of analysis of alchemy is much, much bigger than the molecular and atomic level, right?
So. Yeah, because it wasn't like necessarily a moving away from religion into science, but more like a way to marry the two or to explain the stuff that they were seeing in religion or had heard about in their religion with ways they could manipulate it by human hands. And so it was, And then they just sort of went like, oh, well, maybe there's a reason for it on Earth that's not necessarily divine.
And in the history of science, one of the main reasons, if not the main, I would argue the main philosophical reason given to do science was dominion over the natural world. Because prior to science, the natural world kicked humans' ass pretty hard all the time. Between natural disasters and famine and pestilence and, plague, the world kicked our ass for a long time. So,
Now it's our time to kick its ass.
Francis Bacon, one of the earliest philosophers of science in the 16th century, maybe in 15th, I think, he was writing about how, one of the reasons to do this is to have dominion over nature, which has been so hard on us. And, part of that is figuring out how to change things, transformation. As the American philosopher Walter White reminds us, chemistry is the science of transformation.
Oh, my science.
Jesse. Yeah, and I mean, of course, that can still have a religious undertone because isn't it like a divine right from God that man should be in charge of everything on Earth, right? Like that was so, why not control it through science and marry those two together?
Well, I mean, that's one of the reasons early scientists were able to sell it to the religious leaders and, monarchs of their area or local lords was like, well, this is kind of, this is from the Bible. This is also from Genesis.
Yeah.
What we're doing is just Genesis.
We're just doing Genesis. We're just not as good at it as God was because we aren't him. Okay?
Exactly.
King, whatever.
But we are made in his image and we can try.
We can damn well try. Okay. There's a little theological garden path that we went on. So to sum it up, maybe he just liked an Archangel Michael statue for
Nigel?
Scoring his things.
Nigel?
Mr. Archangel.
You could just imagine God and Jesus saying, Michael, go tell them again. Michael.
Okay.
Okay.
There's one for the bingo card. We made an Arrested Development joke. What else do we got? He's been stabbed. He's got that Emperor Palpatine skin. Jesus is, yeah. Okay.
Isn't it cool that his name is Jesus and Angel's name is Angel?
Yeah, Angel de la Guardia, guardian angel. Did not do a lot of protecting. There's a really, at the very end of the movie, after they have the big fight with Angel, he like crashes through the skylight, Angel's dead, Jesus is dying, but he's just got like white paint all over him, and not like the face paint that was his, you know, his new skin, his like marbleized skin. It just looked like there was drips of white house paint on him, and I have no idea where that came from. I don't know.
Maybe it's his blood.
Oh, you think he's got white blood now? You know, that's as good a reason as anything else I could come up with. It was like, maybe he broke through a paint gallery.
Yeah, also, like, that building was weird. It was just like a construction building that was never finished, and then somehow on the top floor, it was just like a very sterile room that wasn't that good because like it was like, hey, in order to bring the food in, we just open this thing and there's no in between section, right? It's just goes straight from the outside to the inside. It's just a window and then you go in anyway.
It's a sliding door that you then walk through a revolving door beside it and pull the entire roasting pan of pills. Yeah
And if it was for security, it was clearly very bad because, you know, Jesus just put Aurora through it and then she just let him in from the main door.
She just crawled through.
It was just a very strange, like, I don't understand the purpose of it. Like, it was his like evil supervillain lair that wasn't very well designed to keep people or germs out.
Yeah, and I was like, is this the, because I think Ron Perlman's character was a private security firm or something, or a private investigator. I was like, so he just owns this like half completed building, or maybe they're in the process of building it. But yeah, there's like, what do we need? We need metal girders, a freight elevator, and a not very good clean room. Okay, let's find it. Maybe that was just what he could build for sets. Like, you know, this was an indie, so I didn't even look at the budget and box office or anything like that.
I got it.
You got it.
Yeah.
Or does the dog die? I missed like all my things.
Budget was $2 million, and the box office was $621,392.
Not great.
But it was a limited release in only two theaters in North America.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
It's tough to make money that way.
Yeah, it grossed $17,500 on its opening weekend, and then a total of 28 screens. So not very many.
Okay. So maybe this is why we didn't hear about it before today.
Yeah. And then it has 89% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
There you go. Yeah, it's a weird one. I know that it was kind of slow and ponderous, but I would be lying if I said it didn't stick with me since watching it on Thursday night and just kind of like turning it around in my head. I think the storytelling of the family drama is interesting, and I loved seeing how Guillermo del Toro started out. And I guess that has been my final thoughts for this movie. So why don't we go to you, Alex?
I mean, it's definitely different. It's a very wild, wild difference between From Dusk Till Dawn to this, you know?
Yeah. Oh boy.
It's a very different movie, very different pacing. I do agree with Luke where, you know, I did find some of it pretty slow and a little, like, which is weird because it's not a slow movie. No. Or it's not a long movie.
It's not too long either, yeah.
It's still like, it's like just under an hour and a half, I think, or just around there. But I did everything I liked about Let the Right One In, I liked about this one, you know. Mm-hmm. It's more so the behind the vampire part, like the human connection with the vampire, which in this case was Aurora with Jesus. I really liked the relationship of that, and just it was something different, you know. It was something that I haven't really seen much of before in the vampire lore.
It's unlike anything else, for sure.
It was unlike anything else. Villains were pretty weak, though. Ron Perlman and his uncle were pretty lame. But
Uncle Denethor.
I generally enjoyed this movie.
Nice. All right, what about you, Luke? Final thoughts.
I didn't like this movie, but I didn't dislike it. I'm pretty lukewarm about it. And more than anything, I actually just don't remember it.
Fair enough.
It didn't grip me. It just didn't grip
me. Fair enough. I think, I don't know, there's something about this movie where the villain or the thing that's controlling everything can be defeated by just getting smashed with a brick. And so that's an interesting way to finish the movie. Because that's all it takes to get rid of the Chronos device is a couple good whacks with a brick. This bug is dead. Okay, then. Well, let's give it a scariest part if we have one or something akin to that. Alex, have you got one?
No scariest part, but the grossest part was him licking the blood off the floor in the bathroom. Because first of all, he's licking someone else's blood. Second of all, it's on the floor of a bathroom. Third of all, he's in a very vulnerable position where anyone walks in is like, what the fuck are you doing? Which kind of does happen. He gets the boot to the face.
Yep.
But yeah, that was definitely my most unsettling part of the movie.
Yeah, that's like the grossest part. I thought the bug was going to be scarier and grosser. Like, it looked like an interesting little puppet that was wriggling around inside this Chronos device. I kind of wish that had been more of a thing and we got to see more of it aside from just like this weird thorax filling up with blood. Bugs are creepy crawly, so I'm going to pick that for my scariest part.
Grossest part, some of the prosthetics on Jesus. Scariest part, Ron Perlman's acting.
Take that, Ron Perlman. Yes, he was much better as Hellboy, which also Del Toro. Okay, so then we got to rate it. We got to rate it out of something, and we got to give it a rating.
We are going to rate it out of 5 cockroaches that come out of the Archangel Michael himself's eyeball.
Oh, man, I'm changing my answer of scariest part of the movie is the cockroaches. I don't like that. Gross. That was gross. I forgot about it. I remember. It's gross. Please continue the rating.
Yeah, it was fine. Very different than anything else that I've ever seen, but I enjoyed most of it, and I'm glad I watched it because I do like Del Toro, and this is kind of shows where he came from, you know? So I'll give it 3 cockroaches coming out of the Archangel Michael himself's eye socket out of 5.
All right. Yes, I think I share all the same thoughts as you, and I will also give this one 3 cockroaches crawling out of the eye socket of Michael the Archangel out of 5.
The art direction and cinematography of this film are really good, and I think everything else is just kind of subpar. So I'm going to give it 2 cockroaches out of Archangel Michael's eye out of 5.
There we go. That's been Chronos, everyone. Thank you for listening. Let's move on to Something to Cheer, the best segment of the podcast. It's what you're all waiting for. So, Alex, what are you cheering this week?
It's been a pretty uneventful week, but I would say my cheer is the new Lana Del Rey album. It's been a very emotional listen for me, but as is with Lana Del Rey. So, yeah, I like it. It's good.
Nice. New Lana Del Rey album. Luke Mason, what are you cheering? I know you got trivia coming up.
Yeah. Did I cheer guest hosting last week? I don't remember.
You teared it up as
Luke. You cheer trivia literally every week. But
did I cheer? I can't remember. What was my last week's cheer?
So I just finished the edit. You cheered the fact that you are guest hosting trivia on the 30th? Okay. 31st. Yeah.
So I have to think of a different.
No, you can cheer the same thing.
Oh, well, okay.
How are that's on your mind?
I'll cheer one of the categories I came up with for that trivia. But the two of you have to agree to an NDA so that you don't tell any of my friends before Thursday what the questions are. But I'm really proud of this category.
I don't know any of your friends. I know Billy, that's it.
So the shtick of this particular trivia is always kind of like a pun or a weird category. And so one of my categories is The Simpsons by Another Name. So it's going to be like a general knowledge category, but every correct answer shares the first name of a Simpsons character. And I'm pretty proud of that. It's going to be really good.
Can you tease us a question? This is going to come out well after it. So
I sure can. I could probably do it. See if you know it. Okay. This Simpson by Another Name was the 16th president of the United States. Oh, and Buzz, and yes,
who is Abraham Lincoln?
That's right. So part of it is, yes, like, you don't even need the full name of the question. You just need the first name of the Simpsons character, and I'll give you the point.
Ah, okay.
So it's like that. So this one is really hard. It's like, this Simpson by another name unified Germany in 1871 and was the first chancellor until 1890. Any guesses on that one?
Wilhelm?
Otto von Bismarck. Or Otto.
Otto von Bismarck.
Oh, so, like, even though some of the questions are ridiculous, they're guessable if you just know the first names of Simpsons characters.
So it's not just Simpsons family, it's Simpsons
characters. Mm-hmm. My personal favorite is, this Simpson by another name is located at 49.29 whatever degrees north and 117 point whatever degrees west. This is very guessable.
Hang on.
Do you want a hint?
Aha! Oh.
Oh, that's where you live.
Oh, that's gonna annoy
I got
shit
it
out of some people.
Burnaby.
Yeah, Burnaby.
Good.
Burnaby Munz.
Springfield. Burnaby.
So I don't know. I'm just really excited.
That's a good one. Okay. Very good cheer. Very good cheer. Boy. I have had, like I said, a very stressful week. And there's not much to cheer except for the fact that by the time this episode comes out, I'll be finished the regular semester and just into, what's it called, finals. And I'll be almost done my second year of my degree. So I'm looking forward to that. This has
second out of how many?
Second, if I can get all my classes figured out, I can finish next year. So I got to figure that out. But like I said, in a different section, maybe in a different episode, because we split this up, my registration is all screwed up and everything's full for next year. So I got to talk to my advisor and be like, let me take classes. I don't want to keep coming to school. I just want my degree. So yay, school. Almost done. Something to cheer. And that's going to put an end on the episode as well. So next week, we've got week 3 of Vampire Month, and it's my choice. And I think this one's definitely going to be a vampire movie. And I'm not sure
Blade.
How we're going to like it. Oh, man, I wish we could do Blade or Blade 2. Or
what do you
Blade
mean you
3?
Wish? Just do it if you want.
Could. I don't want to pick it. Although Blade 2 was directed by Guillermo del Toro, so.
It was, yeah.
Yeah. But I'm not doing that one. I'm going kind of in the 80s with another vampire team up movie. And so we're going to check out The Lost Boys. Got some Kiefer Sutherland, some Corey Feldman. I think one of the guys from Bill and Ted is in it.
Nice.
Alex Frost. Yeah. So The Lost Boys. We're going to check that out. And until then, stay cool, everybody. I'll say goodbye. Luke, say goodbye.
Say goodbye.
That's it. Alex, say goodbye.
I don't think I will.
Great.
Not this week. Maybe next time.
I don't understand the comment, and I won't respond to it. All right. Well, stay safe, everybody. And remember, they're just movies. There's nothing to fear.